The fact that the film never happened and never was completed affected only one career, it's Clouseau's career, and mostly because he had a heart attack and of course he couldn't be insured anymore, so there would not be many more Clouseau films. There would actually be only one, La Prisonnière. For the others, they all suffered because they expected so much and had given so much on the set. But it was so painful that in the end, I think everyone was happy that it would end. Costa Gavras told me that when he was shooting Claire de Femme with Romy Schneider about 10 years later, he asked her, what happened on the set? Why did the filming end? And Romy said, I'm not speaking of Inferno. It's too painful. It's over now. I will not speak. It was awful. It was so painful.
Filmmaker Serge Brumbert discussing his cinematic resuscitation of sorts of Henri-Georges Clouseau's unfinished film, The Inferno. We'll preview this weekend's special screening at the Barbican here in London, complete with a live electronic score, today on The Cinema Show. Also ahead.
This new building was completed in 1885. In memory of those killed in the blaze, it was called the Sunhaus, House of Atonement, the title of Meyer's film.
We'll touch down in Vienna for a visit to the city's unluckiest address. And a little later...
In Brazil now, the country is divided politically. And whenever a citizen of a certain stature says what he or she thinks, it becomes a political statement and it becomes something much bigger than it should be.
Since its premiere at Cannes, audiences have wondered just how much of the film Aquarius was inspired by the ousting of Brazil's president. We'll ask its director, Kleber Mendonça Filho. That's all to come on this world tour edition of The Cinema Show on Monocle 24.
Clouseau was France's Alfred Hitchcock, but of course in a different way. Hitchcock was British and had started in the silent years. Clouseau made his first film in the 1941, although he was a scriptwriter since the early 30s and made even a very short film in 1931. Clouseau was more impressed by Boileau and Narcejac, who were the writers of Vertigo, so they were on the same path with Hitchcock. He was more into the human brain, human cruelty. In a way, Hitchcock was more sophisticated, was more studio approved. Clouseau was not studio approved by far. He was someone so structured inside by his own anxiety.
In the late 1960s, legendary French filmmaker Henri-Georges Clouseau began work on what he thought would be his next project. Teaming with cameraman Andreas Winding and Armand Thiroux, about 12 hours of film footage was shot, capturing a series of abstract experimental scenes involving stars Romy Schneider, Serge Rajani, and Catherine Allégret. But the film was never completed. The footage was shelved and largely forgotten. Welcome to The Cinema Show on Monocle 24. I'm Ben Rylan. What began as a chance encounter between filmmaker Serge Brumbert and Clouseau's widow culminated in The Inferno Unseen, a 2009 collation of remnants of what might have been had Clouseau finished The Inferno. Serge Brumbert's vision of the film will be shown at a special screening at the Barbican here in London as part of the Fashion in Film Festival this Sunday, the 26th of March, complete with a live electronic score by Rollo Smolcom. But before all of that, to tell us more about how the film came about, we sent Monocle's Paris correspondent Tom Burgess Watson to meet Serge in Paris.
This film, Henri-Georges Clouzot's Inferno, has been described as a making-of documentary of a film that was never made. That's how one critic put it. Is that a fair assessment, do you think?
That's exactly what it is. The film started as the biggest project of the year 1964 in France. Three crews, the most important actors, technicians and everything. There were 6 months of tests and trials in the Boulogne studios, and then they went on shooting on location in July 1964. After 2 weeks of shooting, when 20 weeks of shooting were planned in the first place, the entire thing stopped and disappeared, and no one knew what Inferno would ever be. It was shot without anyone on the stage. No one was allowed to speak. Even after the shooting and until today, people didn't speak at all about what happened on the shooting, what went wrong, why it did stop. But most of all, not one frame of the film seemed to have survived. Everything has been destroyed. So this biggest film project of the 60s in France ended up in void, in complete emptiness. Was it a mystery? Was it a drama, a disaster? What happened on the stage? That's exactly what we wanted to know. So we tried to find the cans and realized that actually, although the work print has completely disappeared with the sound and the positive image, some shots of the negative had remained in the original film laboratory, LTC. And those shots were not accessible and were held in secrecy in the French archives because there had been a lawsuit. The lawsuit ended up in a no decision. The insurance company, which from now on owned everything on the film, did not own one little detail, the script. The story and the script were still the possession of Clouzot himself. And Clouzot and the insurance company never could get along. So the judge eventually said 10 years after the shooting in 1974, no one will be allowed to reveal the existence or show or access any of those cans until both parties find an agreement. Then the company went to other projects, of course, and Clouzot passed away 3 years later. So basically the films were held in secrecy in the French archives, were not allowed to reveal that they had the films. Our aim, when we found out where the films were, was to make peace between the insurance company and the widow of Clouzot, Inès Clouzot. The insurance company could be taken care of with a big check. That was easy. Expensive, but easy. The widow was another matter. She told me that because Clouzot had never allowed anyone to access or touch or deal with that film, which had been a nightmare to him, she would never allow anyone to do anything with the film unless something really special happened. Because, she told me, you must realize that every year 5 or 10 people come to me with the same request. We would like to write on the film, write on the project, what happened and so on. So I went to her, explained that I was a producer, that I'm a director, that I knew a lot about Clouzot, but of course I hadn't seen one image of the film and all I knew was what I had read in the papers. And I must say I added the word special in every sentence because I wanted her to feel that it was a special moment, a special this, a special that, that in the end something special happened, that she would give me the film. And at the end of my presentation of about 1 hour, she told me, you know, you didn't tell me anything special, although you are rather enthusiastic, so I'll do exactly what I told you. I will not give you the film or the rights to do anything with it, but I'll see you to the elevator. She lives on the 7th floor. So I'm here at the elevator, totally devastated, and I try my luck one last time while the elevator is going up. And I say, listen, we cannot split like this. I mean, we must meet again. I must explain again. I'm sure I'm the right person and so on. And she smiled and said, oh, well, you never give up, do you? Listen, here is what I'll do. I will not give you the films because nothing special happened, but I will see you to the main hall of the building. So she enters with me in the elevator, and we go down, and between the second and the third floor, the elevator stops, gets stuck. There's a puncture, a problem. And we are stuck in this elevator for about 2 hours, and I'm claustrophobic and she's claustrophobic, and it's a very small elevator, and we start discussing our lives and so on, because everything that had to be told had been told about the film in the meeting just before, when the repairman from the elevator took us out of that little cabin. She told me, well, you see, something special happened, the elevator got stuck, I give you the film, that's fine with me. And that's how the entire adventure started.
So you got your hands on 185 cans of film containing several hours of footage. What sort of a condition were the film rolls in when you got them?
There were about 180 cans of film, and within each can were little rolls of separate takes, which were the takes that Clouseau had approved for pre-editing, that, let's say, possibilities for editing. We had to assemble every single of them because there was no leader or anything, and they were scattered totally at random, and they were negative film, so we had no clue what was in those film cans, which explains that when we put the films on the telecine, which was the only way to see those negatives in positive, for the first time in 40 years, someone could see those images at random. They didn't mean anything, but they certainly were fascinating.
It was a boiling hot summer, the summer of 1964, and while they were filming, there was a heat wave. Does that sort of heat come across in the film? Can you see the actors and the actresses suffering under the duress of that heat? Do you think that was perhaps one of the unfortunate, unpredictable accidents that led to this film spiraling out of control?
In 1964, there was a heat wave, and obviously they are shooting in July. It must be very hot. You hardly see it on the images, but what we know for sure is that the last day of the shooting, Clouseau was on his boat watching the two girls, Danny Carell and Romy Schneider, kissing each other with their lips painted in blue. Don't ask me why, that's what it was. And he asked for one take, two takes, five takes, 20 takes. We have up to take number 35 written on the clapboard. It was shot at 3 a.m. in the middle of the lake on that boat. And that very moment that Clouseau had his heart attack. So is it because of the heat? Is it because of the women? Is it because it was to happen? But well, it happened under the sun, in a terrible heat.
Serge Brumbaugh speaking to Monocle's Tom Burgess Watson. If you're in London, you can catch a special screening of The Inferno Unseen at the Barbican this Sunday, the 26th of March. Our globe-trotting tour continues with a stopover in Brazil soon, but first, a quick flight to Vienna. Last year, independent Austrian filmmaker Maya McKechnie released a documentary film that sheds light on a specific address in Vienna that's been plagued by misfortune. It's seen fires, suicide, and injustice, and it's come to symbolize Austria's troubled history. The film is called House of Atonement, and Monocle's Alexei Korolev went along to visit with Maya.
This is Schottenring 7, perhaps Vienna's unluckiest address, and I've come here to meet someone who's intimately familiar with its ill-fated history.
My name is Maya McKechnie, and I'm a filmmaker. I made the film Sühnhaus, which in English translates to House of Atonement. When I came to Vienna, I went to the Criminal Museum a lot, which is in the second district, in a very old house, and you walk down the clammy stairs and there's mold on the walls and very strange place, and they keep a head there, and this is the head of one of the victims of the fire, the blackened, charred head of a woman, and nobody knows her name. And I was just getting curious and thought, how can this be in the year of 2000, you know, how can they keep parts of real humans there? And I tried to research the story of that head.
The fire that Maya is talking about is the infamous Ringtheater fire of December the 8th, 1881, that burned down an entire theater right here on a premiere night.
On that property, hundreds of people met their deaths within half an hour. After a gas explosion, they fought their way through the dark theater, tumbled downstairs, pushed desperately at windows and doors, piled up against walls that wouldn't give way, clutching at each other, choking.
The huge death toll, 386 people, was a result of a flaw in construction as well as negligence by the firefighters and police, who hesitated for more than 20 minutes before moving in.
In Vienna streets, people aren't supposed to think about the fire anymore or remember the ill-fated theater. A new building had to be constructed quickly where the fire took place, something magnificent that spoke of the emperor's generosity.
This new building was completed in 1885. In memory of those killed in the blaze, it was called the Sühnhaus, House of Atonement, the title of Meyer's film. But it wasn't a theater, it was a block of flats. One of its first tenants was a little-known psychiatrist named Sigmund Freud.
Well, of course, my film is a little bit of fiction also. No, I think I have to say this differently. It's not fiction, but of course I selected those parts which fit into the story, which fit into the picture. And I was searching for unlucky stories concerning this address. But it was very easy to find those stories, I have to say. I didn't find many stories of happy moments in this address. Since Freud lived here, and I think a lot of those stories have been brushed under the carpet, you know.
Another fire.
Yes. always lots of police.
In an ironic and gruesome twist of fate, the Sühnhaus also ended up in flames at the very end of the Second World War. In March 1945, with the Soviets and Allies approaching, the Nazis were feverishly burning official documents in a nearby building. The resulting fire spread to Schottenring 7. Today, this site is occupied by a faceless concrete edifice that houses, of all things, a police headquarters.
I think there is something like a collective memory in cities. And in Vienna, this place is not really remembered, not as this site, you know. Like, people know there was the Ringtheater, there was a big fire, but they changed it into a story of success. They said, okay, there was this big fire, but it led to a lot of security measures, and now we have, you know, we have the Iron Curtain in theaters, and we have firemen sitting in each play, and everything is safe now, and it led to something good, so it's a story of success. And there's no plug for Sigmund Freud either, you know, who used to live here for 5 years. His first three children were born in this very place, and there's no plug and nothing. You know, Beethoven in Vienna, he composed 3 months here and 1 year here, and every side he stayed. Maybe he just slept a couple of nights, he has a plug. But about Freud, I don't know. It seems to be something different. Viennese people don't seem to be very proud of this place, of course.
What was the most traumatic or the most striking moment in that whole story for you when you were researching it?
I think the most striking moment when doing this film was discovering that there was a special door where we are standing right now, over there. Mm-hmm. There used to be a wooden door which wasn't very wide. It was like 2 meters and 50, maybe 3 meters wide. And this was the special entrance for people who had the cheap tickets for the theater performances. And it led to a very dark and narrow staircase, windowless staircase, and people were really crammed inside, so they tried to make as much money as possible by putting as many people inside the building as they could. The theater had a fourth gallery, so it went way up high to the ceiling, where it was also very hot because the big chandelier was under the ceiling. So discovering that they had this very badly built special entrance for poor people, and that most of the dead from the fire really went inside that door. That was a strange feeling, especially since that door is still in a museum. It didn't burn, and supposedly it didn't burn because people were just piling up behind that door and they couldn't get out.
And when the film finally came out, what were the people saying to you in general?
At one point, what made me a little anxious is when somebody from the relative of a person who was in charge, the relative of the fireman who was put on trial for the Ringtheater fire. And he was in the film, and I thought, how is he going to react? And he had tears in his eyes, and he said, like, he so much likes the film, and he thinks it's so empathic and compassionate, and he's so happy somebody tackles the subject that's been going round and round in his head for such a long time. And it's interesting to see that it still goes on in the histories of families of victims and families of people who were in charge, even though it was centuries ago. I think it's still there in the way people feel about Vienna and feel about this spot and feel about many things.
For Monocle in Vienna, I'm Alexei Korolev.
Thank you, Alexei. This is The Cinema Show. We'll head to Brazil next. The world of business is often quite a pushy place, and the movie business is certainly no different. In fact, it might just be the pushiest of them all. But with just the right blend of stubbornness and confidence, there are a few who have bucked the trend and sailed a successful career wave on their own terms. Perhaps most notably, Katharine Hepburn.
Do you think you're a good actress? I'm a funny actor. I always feel that I'm a sort of amateur actor. I don't know why.
After being first spotted on the stage and begrudgingly tempted to Hollywood for a screen test, Hepburn demanded the sky-high salary of $1,500 a week, an astronomical sum for an unknown actress. But the director George Cukor knew there was something different about her talent, and he convinced the studio RKO to agree. Her debut film, opposite the daunting presence of John Barrymore, shimmered without any hint of jitters. And after the completion of her third picture, she already had an Academy Award for Best Actress. After a string of failures in the late 1930s, Hepburn was affixed with the label Box Office Poison. Harry Brandt wrote that piece entitled Dead Cats in the May 3rd, 1938 edition of the Independent Film Journal, which also listed others including Greta Garbo, Joan Crawford, and Hepburn's first co-star, John Barrymore. That was May, and yet by June, Hepburn had her name on yet another classic picture, Holiday.
How's your garden grow, Case? Is life wonderful where you are?
Can be.
But it hasn't been?
Well, I don't call what I've been doing living.
And what do you recommend for yourself, Doctor?
George Cukor's classic romantic comedy is screening right now in the United Kingdom on Mubi, the curated movie site of cult, classic, and award-winning films. As for Hepburn, well, her response to the Box Office Poison article took everyone by surprise. After buying herself out of her contract with RKO, she secured the film rights to a play, The Philadelphia Story, which she then sold to MGM on the condition that she be cast in the lead. MGM were so concerned about her fading appeal that they cast two top-shelf leading men to support her, Cary Grant and James Stewart. The film, it was a roaring success. Sample a whole month of Mubi for free right now. Head over to mubi.com/monocle. That is MUBI/monocle. This is The Cinema Show on Monocle 24. I'm Ben Rylan. Now, no matter where in the world you happen to be, film is rarely far from politics. And that's certainly the case at our next destination, Brazil. Since its premiere at Cannes last year, Aquarius has become one of the most talked about films in its home country. Much of its initial reputation stemmed from a rather conspicuous protest by the film's cast in Cannes shortly after the ousting of Brazil's former president Dilma Rousseff. But aside from the political undercurrent, Aquarius attracted its share of praise from critics and audiences and performed very well at the box office too, particularly in France and, of course, Brazil. The film follows a successful music critic, played by the legend Sonia Braga, living in a beautiful seafront apartment. But while the waves lap at her window, she's more concerned about a powerful developer lapping at her front door. Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco spoke to the film's director, Kleber Mendonça Filho.
Sei que esse projeto, o novo Aquário, só vai sair mesmo do papel quando você tiver uns 50 ou 60 anos de idade.
Pode ser. Talvez. Agora tem gente que não pensa assim.
É?
É. Os seus filhos,
pode... Não fala do meu filho! De nenhum deles! Cala sua boca!
Every time I make a film, and this is my second film, but I had been making short films before making the features, I always wonder what's going to happen to each film. And you can always hope for the best. And the relative success of Aquarius and the way it's been traveling all over and, you know, with distribution in almost 70 countries, it's always a surprise, yeah. Especially because it's a very personal film, which I shot not very far from where I live, on Boa Viagem Beach in Recife, and it's widely seen as a universal story, and that's a beautiful thing. You know?
But it also touched a raw political nerve in Brazil as well, because, I mean, clearly you're a very, you know, in a way, political person, or just expressing your opinion. Do you think, in the end, I know it's a personal film, but this became bigger, you know, in Brazil. I think even in the box office, it did very well, but at the same, a lot of people boycotted the film, so you became quite a controversial figure in Brazil. How did you feel about that?
For me, that's the strangest thing ever, because I do not see myself as a political figure. I do not have any plans to run for any office. I don't want to be a politician. I'm just a guy who made a film, and because of, you know, where the film has taken me, I usually have, you know, microphones pointed at me, like, you know, it's happening right now with you. And sometimes questions are asked, and I answer these questions very honestly as a Brazilian citizen. And that's only my opinion. The problem is that in Brazil now, and it's happening also in the United States, the country is divided politically. And I think the Brazilian media is kind of sedated in terms of offering opinion. And whenever a citizen of a certain stature says what he or she thinks, it becomes a political statement, and it becomes something much bigger than it should be. So the biggest surprise in these 9 months traveling with Aquarius, the fact that I'm being seen as some kind of political, I don't know, political player, which I'm not, you know, I'm not a political player. I'm just a filmmaker who as a citizen has expressed a few points of view.
Some people even said, and clearly I believe this is not true, but you can correct me, that they made parallels between Clara and Dilma. But, you know, the fact, I believe the film was made before this whole thing happened. But, I mean, you can have some sort of comparison between those two in a way. But I think this almost happened by accident, right?
Well, I mean, yes. I wrote the script in 2012 when we shot the film in 2015. I could not have imagined that what happened ended up happening, which is the very questionable impeachment process which ousted this woman from where she lived, you know, which is basically what makes the story very similar to Aquarius. But ultimately, it happens a few times, and it has happened many times in history with books, with films. It's not the first time that a certain work of art or a piece of culture seems to capture a few things that are happening in society. You know, it's the zeitgeist. And it's very easy to draw parallels. But technically speaking, I never made a film about Dilma. This is a crazy idea. You know, I made a film about a woman and her building, and that's what the film is. If the film is resonant enough, you can make anything you want out of it.
Brazilian filmmaker Kleber Mendonça Filho speaking to Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Aquarius is out now in cinemas across the UK. We had planned to sit down for a lesson in film criticism from Australian legend David Stratton this week, but, well, unfortunately, we've run out of time. But we'll be sure to bring you that story on next week's show.
I started my filing system when I was about 12 years old. For some time before that, started writing notes about all the films I saw.
Today's program was mixed and edited by Kieran Matthew Banerjee and researched by Yolene Goffin. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast wherever you get your audio. The Cinema Show is back next week. I'm Ben Ryland. Thank you for listening.